First, I'd like to join the chorus of thanks to Mary for inviting us, and also to Mary and her assistants for making what is obviously more or less impossible seem actually easy. It's very nice to be here. This is not quite the talk that is described in the program. It's the talk I wrote on my way to the talk that is described in the program. I wanted to talk about distraction, but I found I had to talk about bewilderment first. Henry James said that it seems probable that if we were never bewildered, there would never be a story to tell about us. I take it that James is pointing both to the need for stories and the opportunity for stories that is represented by bewilderment, that if we're not bewildered, we tell stories because we need to tell them, and we tell them because we're given the chance. There's also quite a bit in this talk about forgetting, which chimes quite nicely with a lot of what was said yesterday, of course, with completely unintentionally, but unintentional chimes are perhaps sweetest. The first thing we forget about moving pictures is that they don't move. They succeed each other at the right speed, 24 frames a second or a little bit slower. And it's not just we see movement where there's materially only a fast sequence of still images. We don't see any gaps in what appears on the screen to be real time. This temporal continuity, Marianne Downes says in her book, The Emergence of Cinematic Time, this temporal continuity is in fact haunted by absence, by the lost time represented by the division between frames. During the projection of a film, the spectator is sitting in an unperceived darkness for almost 40% of the running time. End of quote. This darkness is still unperceived even when we view a film on tape or disc, but now, of course, we do see the individual frames if we stop or slow the apparent movement. We could always do this if we had access to an editing machine, but now we do it without thinking every time we stop for coffee or to rewind the film a bit. Digital technology, Laura Mulvey says, enables a spectator to still a film in a way that evokes the ghostly presence of the individual celluloid frame. Close quote. Evokes the ghostly presence for old moviegoers, that is, not for anybody else. Technically, Mulvey continues, this is an anachronism. It is only due to an imaginative association with film's archaic structure that the material of celluloid comes to mind. End of quote. Here we have unperceived darkness, an imaginative association with what we never saw, and a vision of movement where there is none. No wonder film theorists are always talking about the uncanny. But there was movement. We saw it. What we saw was not an illusion, or not an illusion in the most frequently used sense of the term, something that deceives or deludes by producing a false impression, as the OED. The impression produced by many films is exactly the opposite of false. We think we've never seen anything quite so true. We really see the movement, and the movement is often real. If we had been at a railway station in France on a famous cinematic occasion, we would have seen the train too. The camera didn't make it up. And what we now see on the screen, and we watched that piece of early film, the Lumière brothers' arrival of a train in the station of La Ciotat, is not just technology. It is the result of a technology that allows us to supply the missing movement and to miss the two-swift passage of the empty spaces. There is something both tantalizing and incoherent about the ideas of unperceived darkness and a memory of what we didn't see. And there is an interesting philosophical slippage on almost everything written on this subject. For example, in a well-known article by Joseph and Barbara Anderson, attacking and destroying the notions of persistence of vision as the basis of movement on film, they say, first, to the visual system, the motion in a motion picture is real motion, as I've just said. And they also say, we know that the individual pictures of a motion picture are not really moving and that our perception of motion is therefore an illusion. Real motion, illusion. We see one thing and we know another. This situation recalls a well-known anecdote about Wittgenstein, which appears in Tom Stoppard's Travesties as well as in many books and memories. Wittgenstein asks his students one day in his rooms in Huell Court, other versions of the story have him talking to Elizabeth Anscombe, why they think people once imagined the sun revolved around the earth. There's a pause, and the answer comes, I suppose, because it looks as if it does. Wittgenstein says, and how would it look if it didn't? And it takes a little while to sort of to fall through the crack, this one. When Marianne Down tells us that the cinema, quote, affirms the reality, indeed the allure, of a mobility that is quite simply not there, she catches the eeriness of the whole technological enterprise, to say nothing of the human psychology involved. But of course, the mobility is there, too. Galileo did not stop us from talking about sunrise and sunset. We supply missing movement all the time, and not just in the cinema. We see what's not there, and we see what's not happening. Language itself, I want to suggest, once we go beyond the most basic transactions like getting a cup of coffee, requires us to animate it, to put flesh on its poor old bones and to shake them. In a famous poem, a group of trivial women discuss Michelangelo ignorantly and in high-pitched voices. The poet invites us to think of them with contempt. This description of a moment in the love song of Jamfred Prufrock seems reasonable, and the premises are certainly sound. The women, if they existed, would be trivial and ignorant or not. Their sounds would have some sort of pitch, high or low, middling. And the poet, in this case T.S. Eliot, presumably has some sort of feeling about the women. However, as Christopher Ricks reminds us, all of these attributes, triviality, ignorance, pitch, and contempt, are adduced by the critics, by four different critics, in fact. The poem says nothing about any such thing. The poem says, in the room, the women come and go, talking of Michelangelo. They're women, they come and go, they talk. We make what we can of the rhyme, perhaps. Perhaps that indicates a little triviality. We make what we can of the reference to Michelangelo. We supply the pitch and the judgments in the way we supply movement in film. Though the technology question now is ordinary language used with exemplary restraint. Of course, we may supply quite different attributes for the women, but the point is that if we have seen them and heard them at all, we shall have supplied something before we know it. Ricks talks of frail incitements to prejudice here, and he quite rightly alerts us to the way the critics, in this case Grover Smith, John Crow Ransom, Helen Gardner, and Hugh Kenner, no lightweights, have missed both the frailty of the incitements and the size of their own presumption. But we might say more broadly that any act of ordinary understanding requires us to supply something, prejudiced or not. We supply a great deal, usually. And imagine we found in the words what we ourselves placed in them, in the way we imagine the images are moving when they're still. What we had to place in them, I want to say, in order to make sense of them. What is really there on the page in the words is what we can't imagine not finding there. The point is not that we are wrong, only that we are very busy. But can we forget what we have perhaps never known? The optical facts, the degree of our own investment in the meanings we think we find. Both Proust and Freud would tell us that this is the only kind of forgetting that matters. The rest is a question of mental misfiling or leaving stuff in the wrong rooms of the mind. But that move is a little too swift in this context. My suggestion involves a more gradual process. First, we remedy our ignorance if we are ignorant. We perceive the darkness, so to speak. Then we try to live with our new knowledge. And then we learn how and when and how much of it we need to forget. Common name for this sequence is critical thinking, although the final forgetting part is usually underplayed. Even Socrates didn't recommend a partial return to the unexamined life. William Emerson reminded us long ago that irony in literature requires the splitting of an audience, even if the splitting occurs within the confines of only one mind. There is an audience for the ostensibly intended message and another, or several others, for whatever else may be found in the words. Of course, we can remember the split or forget it, or we can see nothing but the split. But what if we think not so much of the final visible differences of interpretation that we're familiar with, of identifiable disagreements, as of what has to have been supplied before interpretation of any kind can begin, the perhaps unacknowledged stories and presumptions that lead us to understand the words before us in different ways. What we see, what we read, it's very often, perhaps always, invaded by or subtended by what we think we know and by hopes and fears we are scarcely aware we have. With so much merit and true love and no want of fortune or friends, the happiness of the married cousins must appear as secure as earthly happiness can be. This is Jane Austen's version in Mansfield Park of Happily Ever After. Most informed readers now hear a firm irony in this proposition, are inclined to think anyone who doesn't hear it is not reading properly. The cues are fortune or friends, with no want of fortune or friends, where fortune or friends seemed like a single unit, in which friends must mean something like influential people who can help you out if your fortune should slip. And the other cue, the other big cue, is the rather glaring must appear. The happiness of the married cousins must appear as secure as earthly happiness can be. Must appear? Well, must, but only must appear. A gross translation of the ironic reading might be something like this. These rather dull young folks are going to be about as happy as such people can be, but I don't expect you to get excited about it. Earthly happiness, then, in this context, has a poignant and extravagant feeling to it. We can think about it in more ecstatic forms. We're not going to find them in life or in this novel. But are we sure about all this irony? I don't hear any kind of irony in the phrase merit and true love. Nor do I think that must appear has to take the edgy reading I've just attributed to it. The qualification as secure as earthly happiness can be is cautious and sober, but it can also be taken as a superlative. This is as good as it gets. And must appear is merely an idiomatic way of saying anyone will see this. This is the conclusion any reasonable person will reach. Appear doesn't suggest some dark alternative reality, only the happily visible nature of some forms of happiness. Another famous example. The evening mists were rising now, and in all the broad expanse of tranquil light they showed to me, I saw no shadow of another parting from her. These are the last words of Great Expectations. Pip has just met up again with Estella, with whom he's been infatuated since his youth. He takes her hand, and they step out into the evening light like the hero and the heroine of a Chaplin movie. In an earlier edition, Dickens had written, I saw the shadow of no parting from her. That is, instead, I saw no shadow of another parting. And earlier still, he'd planned an ending in which Pip and Estella met briefly and then went their different ways. Now, the first printed wording, I saw the shadow of no parting from her, is a little curious because of the placing of the negative. Pip sees a shadow, but it turns out to be a shadow of nothing. In the final version, the phrase is perfectly pitched for quite different readings, and the way we read depends deeply on what we want to hear. Pip sees no shadow of another parting. What could be plainer? He sees none because there is none, and there will be none. Or, if we're in a darker mood and have been thinking about the originally planned ending, we may read the sentence as saying, Pip doesn't see the shadow, but there's bound to be one sometime soon, given everything we know about Estella, the shaky grounds of his affection for, and the fact that Dickens could have been a good deal more emphatic about the happy end if he'd wanted to be. As he is in Little Dorrit, for example. They went quietly down into the roaring streets, inseparable and blessed. Pip and Estella are not inseparable and blessed. Or if we're feeling more conciliatory and more Emersonian, we might think Dickens is telling us that even he doesn't know what the future holds for Pip and Estella. Pip just doesn't see a shadow at the moment. This doesn't mean there won't be one, or that there will. The large and all too crude inference I want to draw from these examples is that very substantial matters of belief and assumption are at work in any interpretation of them, at the very least, our own general view of the chances of happiness in marriage and perhaps of happiness at all. It's against this background that we make our particular interpretive decisions. Not all of this, I think, not much of this is likely to be clear to us as we actually read, and perhaps not even afterwards when we're arguing about interpretations. It's the story before the story. But isn't there a large difference between forgetting the stillness of film images and failing to excavate the assumptions we bring to our reading? And indeed to our daily interaction with other people, there is indeed a large difference. But the difference begins to narrow as soon as we start to think about what we have made of the movement of images on the screen, that is, how we, what assumptions and needs we have brought to the, what looks like movement, the longings and the mythologies we have hung on the mere possibility of such movement. Gilles Deleuze, for example, affirms that the task of cinema is to restore our belief in the world. This seems a tall order for any technology or art form, or perhaps tallest of all for the cinema. But in fact, he's only saying what many writers in film have been saying for a very long time, although perhaps not in quite such lyrical or forlorn accents. Still or moving, photography is never far from a whole set of questions about fidelity to the real, which are much more nuanced in discussions of the other arts. The camera catches reality. Walter Benjamin tells us that when looking at a photograph, quote, the beholder feels an irresistible urge to search for the tiny spark of contingency with which reality has, so to speak, seared the subject. Again, photography is pure contingency and can be nothing else, Roland Barthes says. It is as if, on dirait que, Barthes says, the photograph always carries its referent with itself. The photograph, we are told by dozens of scholars, is a trace and not a resemblance, like a footprint or a fingerprint, and not like a cartoon or a painting. It is a chemical revelation, Bout says. Stanley Cavell reminds us, as Bout always does, that a photograph is always a photograph of something. Even if the scenery is fake, it's real fake scenery. This claim is the corollary to something all of the writers I've cited, and many, many more, insist on. The camera does not choose what it sees. It sees whatever is in front of it. Now, plenty of choices are made before and after the camera sees anything, but its own indifference or neutrality of vision is always part of what these choices are about. The suggestion is not that the camera cannot lie, but that it cannot close its eyes. Photography and the cinema, André Bazin says, are discoveries that satisfy once and for all, and in its very essence, our obsession with realism. Now, we could say this is an old story about old photography and old film, a pre-digital tale. And this is the burden of Laura Mulvey's recent book. The book is called Death, 24 Times a Second. In the 1990s, Laura Mulvey says, the story of mechanical photographic reproduction of reality came to an end. The conversion of recorded information into a numerical system broke the material connection between object and image that had defined the earlier history. Close quote. She's right, of course, but at a couple of intricate and very interesting removes, digital technology did not break the material connection to the old order. It unpicked the mythology that appealed so desperately to the material connection. The old story was full of forgetting and highly selective emphasis. Most importantly, it forgot the difference between still photography and the cinema whenever it needed to. The material basis of these technologies cannot have given them what Mulvey calls a privileged relation to reality, although they certainly seem to have had it. Only a large cultural and imaginative investment could do that, and only a culture afraid of having lost reality, I want to suggest, could go on making this investment for so long or get so upset when the analog bank went broke. This is not to say the investment has done nothing for us, only that technology doesn't make investments on its own, any more than the words women and talking will tell us anything about the pitch of anyone's voices or their ignorance. There are confirmations everywhere of the proposition that the camera cannot close its eyes, although I don't think they are based on the material trace of the old technology, only on something like deep verisimilitude. If I see digital pictures of my friends or family, I recognize them at once. And if I see them in a particular place, I take the photograph as evidence that they were there, digital or not. Similarly, if my image is caught on a surveillance machine as I'm robbing a bank, I shall not expect the judge to have any sympathy with the defense based on the history of photography. The interesting thing is that Bout, Benjamin, Bazin, and Cavell, to arrive only at the third letter of the alphabet, will be on the judge's side and not on mine. It is true, there are a series of distinctions that need to be made here. It is true that the camera can catch contingency as no other instrument can. Not true that everything it catches is contingency. Think of all the spontaneously photographed moments that turn out to have been elaborately set in advance. It is not true that the photograph always carries its referent, only that it can carry its referent. The referent may be faked. I have a photograph of Queen Victoria taking tea with President McKinley, whom she never met. It is true that cameras often see what we can't see. That's why the looks on the faces of our relatives in old snapshots are so revealing and sometimes so touching. But the interest of the reminder that a photograph is always a photograph of something is very slender indeed. Of course, we would not have a photograph of Queen Victoria if she hadn't existed, but we wouldn't have any paintings either, and I'm not sure how much a photo of a real waxwork Queen Victoria would tell us about anything except waxworks. Finally, it cannot be right to say, as Bazin said, that photography and the cinema will satisfy our obsession with realism if we have one, because nothing will satisfy it if we have it. Of course, old mythologies never die. They just go to sleep or hide away inside new mythologies. The point of the quibbling I've just done is not to correct the old story, but to show that it is a story, piled high with preferences and need. The story remembers all kinds of significant features of film, but I'm interested especially in what it forgets and how the forgetting works. All the more so since I want to argue in favor of forgetting as well as of remembering. There is much to be said, this is where I almost got to the talk I was going to give, there is much to be said for what one critic calls casual noticing and another calls a studious abandonment to distraction. And I think if we put together the pieces of the various puzzles I've been laying out, we may arrive at last at a thought or two about how the humanities change and how we may change them. We know or we do not know that moving pictures don't move. And in any case, we do not see the darkness between the frames. The pictures really don't move. whether we know this or not. The unperceived darkness is really there. There can be no question, I hope, of wanting to argue that the illusion just is the reality, that what we see trumps what we know or could know. But the illusion, if it is an illusion, I'm not sure what the right word for it is about as real illusions can get. And the truly intriguing thing, it is not only a real illusion, but an illusion of reality, the best such illusion human beings have ever achieved. This is what Bazin means by the obsession with realism. Not with the real, but with realism. That's not with the real, but with representations of the real, what Aristotle used to call mimesis. One of the most curious of many curious questions in the supposedly transparent poetics is that of our delight in imitation. Aristotle calls it a primary instinct and a universal pleasure. The mere sight of imitation. He says, Aristotle, we have evidence of this in the facts of experience. Objects which in themselves we view with pain, we delight to contemplate when reproduced with minute fidelity, such as the forms of ignoble animals and dead bodies. You have to imagine Aristotle watching horror movies with tremendous pleasure here. Ignoble animals and dead bodies, part 13. It's true that Aristotle is a very serious man, and he doesn't linger long with the idea of sheer, unmotivated pleasure, and he immediately says, with a series of dizzying non sequiturs, he says, of course, it is a primary instinct, and it's a universal pleasure, but it's got a purpose. Because we like to learn things. That's why we like to look at imitations, and we learn things. So this flicker of pure, unimproving pleasure is there on the page, but it vanishes. Our hankering for ever meticulous copying of the real may well be an aspect of our loss of belief in the world, and I believe it is. I believe we have lived for a long time in a situation where we keep multiplying copies because we're afraid we've lost the copied. And as we keep losing the copied in the copies and have this desperately deluded idea that the better the copies are, the closer we will be to the reality we're getting further away from because of the perfection of our copies. We can certainly be sure that high-definition TV is not the end of this quest. Now, I am afraid enough of technology of all kinds not to risk showing a film at this point, which would be the entirely appropriate thing to do. But I'd like you to imagine with me, in the spirit of seeing what is not there and seeing and not seeing what is, a very early film version of The Tempest. This is 1908. The director is Percy Stowe, a man who made over 250 short films between 1901 and 1916. In the film, I ask you to watch, Prospero is over-made up and overacting and setting off fireworks in a manifestly cardboard cave. The argument that the camera always catches the referent doesn't do anything for us here or not yet. We just wish we're not seeing quite so much real cardboard. But then, through the cardboard, we catch a glimpse of the sea. The real sea. That is, the photographed real sea. Or, at least, photographed real water. I take it the scene is shot in a studio tank. Dark waves curl in towards us, foam at their tops. A piece of the natural world in motion as convincing as we are ever likely to glimpse, and all the more startling because we glimpse it through the real cardboard that is fake rock. What is happening here, and what will it tell us about the humanities? That's a question I scarcely can begin to answer, but this is the very, very, very timid beginning. First, although the sea appears to be as real as it can be, we are not confused. We know this is a moving picture, and we are not afraid of getting wet. As the first spectators of the Lumiere's train were said to be afraid of getting run over by the train approaching them. Second, we do not, and I suggest we cannot, think this picture sea is really a series of still photographs projected at a certain speed. That's not what we're seeing. It's only an image, but it is a moving image of moving matter. If we've seen the sea, we say that's it. It's the sea. And if we've never seen the sea, then, as Aristotle says for a similar case, the pleasure will be due not to the imitation as such, but to the execution or some such other cause. Now, I think Aristotle can't be right about this. I think if we've never seen the sea, we will say, I've never seen the sea, but I know this is the sea. And we can't talk about the execution. And if Aristotle is willing to say some such other cause, if even Aristotle is willing to abandon his argument in this cavalier manner, we know we must be in very interesting and difficult territory. A later moment, this chimes with what Roger said, that we can, if we wish, think about the technology, think about the stillness of these apparently moving images, and perhaps our knowledge will increase rather than diminish our pleasure, as with score-based readings, or perhaps it will not increase our pleasure, or not diminish it. Earlier, I used examples from literature to suggest the degree of our involvement in what we think we see. our considerable contribution to the meaning or appearance of what is literally or materially before us. I want to propose now that the example of film and the intricate ways in which we think about the impression it makes will tell us something about what is already going on and could go on more in literature and other realms of art and study. It's not exactly a question of the impact of new knowledges and new technologies on the humanities disciplines, as one of the rubrics for the conference neatly puts it. It is a question of a set of relations among old knowledges, new technologies, new and old modes of perception, and changing practices of interpretation. We are all Faustian enough to want to know whatever can be known and to ruin our pleasure for its sake. We are also devoted to the grandest effects of illusion. We are ourselves, as I've been suggesting, huge contributors to illusion, the illusion of movement, the illusion of ready-made literary meaning. We long to learn all about new technologies, and we love to turn them into metaphors. Surely we can't coherently do all of this. We can't unmask our movement or meaning-supplying activities and keep doing them, and we can't remain to the literal facts of the new media and still flourish them as fancy pieces of fancy cultural theory. We really can't do these things coherently. But there are many forms of forgetting and remembering, and my provisional suggestion is that every discipline has its characteristic combination of these two things. That is, every discipline has its modes of forgetting and remembering, its particular intersections, and every discipline could learn other modes of forgetting and remembering. The anecdote about Wittgenstein and the sun can help us here, and so can Empson's idea of irony. We don't think of the sunset as a metaphor, and in one sense it's not. We do lose sight of the sun. But when we realize that we can't attribute any activity at all to the sun without metaphor, it can't set, it can't sink into the sea, it can't fade into the west, we don't stop talking about the sun, nor do we revert to ancient science. We entertain the two views. A good irony has no point, Empson says, unless it is true in some degree in both senses. And a good irony, he also says, must reconcile the opposites into a larger unity or suggest a balanced opposition by setting out two extreme views or accept a lie to find energy to accept a truth or something like that. Empson has the same mode of argument as Aristotle, you'll notice, when at the end of the sentence we throw in something like that. Literature likes to forget and to remember at the same time. And it offers good practice for those who need to sharpen their skills in this area or even need to learn that such double thinking is possible. Film, as we have seen, repeatedly offers a fundamental fable about forgetting, or a fable about innocence, or a fable about longing. Most other disciplines ostensibly have little time for forgetting, but I doubt whether any kind of concentration is possible without forgetting something. And the gap between what we see in the cinema and what we know about the technology of our seeing represents not only a wonderful instance of the clash of undeniable illusion and unseen reality, but an irony in Empson's sense. It doesn't greatly matter, I think, whether we call this clash between the illusion and the reality, or between what we call anything because it's not an illusion and a reality that is a reality. It doesn't matter whether we call this a clash of two truths, a clash of two extreme views, or the conflict of a lie with the truth, as long as our interest in one dimension of the story does not abolish our interest in the other. I want to add a caveat here, though. Just remembering the other story, we prefer one story and remember the other. Just remembering the other story is not enough. Ambiguity in the humanities has become a sort of critical sofa we can lie on while we pretend to think. One of the great temptations of literary studies, cultural studies, film studies, to let different possibilities, in many forms of study, is to let different possibilities, even violent contradictions, just stare each other comfortably in the face. And then happily settle the proposition that life is complicated and there are two sides to every question. This is not irony. This is just sleep. An active investigation of what bewilders us, an active remembering of whatever the other story is, the story we have not chosen would be quite different, and it would involve an exploration of many possible levels and intensities of awareness and distraction. A faint knowledge, for example, of something might enrich a strong illusion, and a memory of an illusion might render knowledge more speculative. As the humanities change around us, we do need, in a great many areas, to see ourselves failing to perceive the darkness we know is there. And then we also need to be able to unperceive the darkness when we need to. Thank you.